Welcome to Pro Bono Radio, presented to you by Queen's Law. The aim of this podcast is to make legal information more accessible and allow for stimulating discussion on interesting and off-center legal topics. Before we begin the show, I would like to emphasize that this show only contains general legal information. None of this discussion should be treated as legal advice. It is merely just insight and ideas regarding what I personally feel to be an interesting area of the law. If you have needs relating to arbitration, please seek the assistance of a legal professional. On this week's episode of Pro Bono Radio, I will be exploring the topic of arbitration, primarily within the context of Major League Sports. For the most part, I'll focus on the National Hockey League. This will involve a discussion of what arbitration is and how it applies to sports, as well as some of my favorite stories from arbitration hearings that have taken place. This discussion will culminate with an analysis and a reflection on how parties have approached the arbitration process in the past and some best practices for approaching the process going forward. So, to start off, what is arbitration? Arbitration is a form of dispute resolution. When two parties cannot decide on an issue, they turn to the assistance of a third party to determine their dispute. The adjudicator, or the arbitrator, typically has specialized knowledge in the relevant field, allowing them to more easily understand the arguments and the evidence that are placed before them. As well, arbitration is a flexible process. The parties can tailor the process to match the nature of their dispute. They can designate timelines, they can decide how evidence will be brought, and which remedies will be available. Unlike other forms of dispute resolution, such as mediation, the decision of an arbitrator is typically final, and it binds the parties. In the sports context, arbitration often takes place when the parties require the assistance of an arbitrator to determine how much the athlete's next contract should be. Despite its advantages, arbitration tends to carry a negative connotation in the sports industry. Why is that? Plenty of stories exist surrounding arbitration hearings that have gone horribly wrong, and working relationships that have been left damaged, far beyond repair. One such story involves New York Islanders general manager Mike Milbury. During the hearing, apparently, he reduced his goalie Tommy Salo to tears, to the point where Salo had to leave the room. It was said by some to be the most horrific character assassination ever seen in arbitration. I wish this was a one-off example, but it's not. This is what can take place in those hearings, and so management and players tend to want to avoid this process whenever possible. Even if teams and players file for salary arbitration, they're still able to settle up until the hearing begins. This means that arbitration hasn't always acted as a mechanism of dispute resolution in the traditional sense, but it has resolved disputes in that it gives a bit of a timeline, as in, if we don't have a deal by July 23rd, we're going to have to go to arbitration and nobody wants that, so let's settle right now. This notion of a damaged relationship is supported by the data, which was collected by The Athletic. Only 27 players in the entire National Hockey League have gone to arbitration in the past 11 seasons. That's less than one per team on average. Of those, over half of them were on new teams within one season of their hearing. Further, within three seasons, over three quarters of those players were on new teams. Now, some of this is attributable to natural roster turnover, but for the most part, this suggests that if you don't settle before your hearing, you probably shouldn't get too comfortable in your current city. The economy and the industry have been doing well for the most part. The NHL recently expanded to Las Vegas, and they're about to expand further into Seattle. TV and sponsorship deals for sports leagues have also been lucrative. We haven't heard as many of the scary stories from arbitration as of late. NHL agent Kurt Overhart says this is no coincidence. Teams have been under less financial pressure, and thus arbitration didn't seem to lead to the same lingering hard feelings as in the past. From a cost-benefit analysis perspective, arbitration just doesn't make as much sense. Sure, you might save a couple $100,000s, and yeah, I know, that's a lot of money for most of us, but for these teams, it's a relatively small amount, especially when you consider that by going to arbitration, they'd be risking relationships with players that they value quite highly. On top of that, arbitration is both expensive and time-consuming. It costs money and time to prepare briefs, build your case, and then there's the matter of travel and accommodations for the hearings. For the parties, it just hasn't been worth it. The issue now is the same one that's been causing problems for everyone, everywhere. Yep, COVID-19. Financial pressures are ramping back up. So are we going to see these lingering hard feelings that Kurt Overhart talked about return? I think so. Teams are feeling the pressure both externally and internally. Externally, for the past few seasons, teams have been budgeting and paying players based on projected increases in the league's salary cap. However, I find it hard to believe that any of these projections included a pandemic. All of a sudden, the league isn't making as much revenue from fan attendance and other factors, and the salary cap, instead of increasing as projected, it is staying the same. Teams that thought that they would have $6 million to spend, all of a sudden only have $2 or $3 million to spend. Internally, owners are feeling the exact same pressure. The economy is down, and revenue for both sports sources and the owners' personal businesses are both struggling. For example, the owner of the Dallas Stars is Tom Gagliardi. He owns one of the largest hospitality companies in North America. That's one of the exact industries that's feeling the squeeze of the pandemic the most. Owners have had to cut back on internal spending, irrespective of the league's salary cap, and thus managers are double handcuffed in what they can spend. These constraints now lead to the resurgence of an issue. Teams are strapped for cash. Managers are incentivized to pinch pennies in order to keep their jobs. They pinch pennies by limiting what they pay to players, regardless of what that player's actual objective value is. So now, there's a greater chance for a divide in what teams and players think the contract value should and can be. It is more likely that they will need to go to arbitration in order to arrive at a suitable number, and as I drew out, arbitration typically doesn't end with a happily ever after. Parties have avoided arbitration like the plague. With the presence of an actual pandemic, arbitration seems inevitable. This makes it more important than ever to answer the question, how can parties approach this process better in order to try to ensure that their working relationship stays as intact as possible? Firstly, I'm going to go back to Kurt Overhart. He's one of the leading agents in the industry, and for good reason. In an interview with The Athletic, Kurt said, if a good representative is doing their job, they will manage their client's expectations going into arbitration. This is sound insight. So much of the process and its consequences are psychological, and being prepared for what's in store can go a long way. It's about knowing this is a business and both sides are arguing in a professional manner. Or, at least they should be, I'll get to that later. You're going to get compared to lesser players. They're going to argue that you're worth less than you think you are. You're going to argue the exact opposite of those points. Occasionally, it does get emotional, but good counsel will keep it objective and professional. Shane Morrison was a player for the Washington Capitals. At his arbitration hearing, it was argued that he was simply a product of being at the right place at the right time. He was getting more ice time as a product of injuries to other, better players, not his stellar play. Now, a lot of people, and especially Shane, could have taken this to heart and his side could have left the hearing fuming. Instead, both the agent and the general managers gave interviews after, and they reflected on it positively. It comes down to an understanding that each side is going to argue its position as favorably as possible. It's the nature of the game. Secondly, there's getting your client involved in the process. It is a known fact that people feel more satisfied with outcomes and more confident in the fairness of a process when they're able to take part in it. Andrew Kopp of the Winnipeg Jets, one of Overhart's clients, talked about compiling his statistics and lists of comparables in preparation for his arbitration. This is a pretty hands-on approach for a client to take. While this is usually the job of the agent or the players' association, Overhart made a great point. Who else knows your story better than yourself? It gives the player a sense of autonomy and involvement. It's harder to feel disrespected by the process when you had the chance to present your side of your story. Additionally, the player gets the chance to sort of see the whole picture. You see what kind of points the other side may be making, and you become a bit more grounded in the process, rather than the expected emotional approach. We're in the age of technology, and the prevalence of statistics and performance reviews in the employment context are at an all-time high. This is true for sports, as the analytics movement has taken baseball, hockey, football, and others by storm. In the arbitration process, statistics represent an objective piece of evidence that the arbitrator can use to form their decision. Going back to Overhart once again, he's known for coming to his hearings armed with reams of statistical data. At the end of the day, it's hard to argue with the cold, hard facts. To illustrate this, I'm going to give you two different approaches so you can decide which appeal you think would be the most effective. To set the scene, we have former Vancouver Canucks forward Brendan Morrison. At the time of his hearing, he was on a line with two of the NHL's most prolific stars, Marcus Naslund and Todd Bertuzzi. Morrison was well outscoring his previous career totals, and asking for a resulting raise, as one should. The first approach was that of the league's lawyer, the lawyer for this league was of the viewpoint that Brendan Morrison was a freeloader. He was leeching points off of the efforts of his linemates. This lawyer steps in front of the arbitrator and tells the story of a mouse and an elephant. There's a wide river in front of them, and they must get to the other side. The mouse looks at the river, and he can't do it himself. So he hops on the elephant's back, and the elephant wades across the river. They finally get to the other side, the elephant's exhausted, and the mouse hops off, exclaiming, "We did it!" The lawyer then turns to the arbitrator and very animatedly yells, "Brendan Morrison is the mouse!" The second approach is one based not in folktales, but in statistics. The league lawyer could have gathered statistics on Brendan Morrison's points from the years before he played on the line with Naslin and Bertuzzi, and then his points from this season while he was on their line. Additionally, the lawyer could have looked at some newer analytics that are called with or without use. This would measure what Brendan Morrison's production during the season was when he was on the ice with Naslin and Bertuzzi, and when he was on the ice but they were not. This would help to isolate the effect of their presence on his points. These would be used to show that Morrison's production was noticeably lower without his star linemates on the ice. So now, which do you think would support the argument that Morrison's success was a product of his linemates? While the former was amusing and probably got a good amount of laughs in the room, I think the latter example is more persuasive. They're hard to argue against when they're telling you exactly what the story is. That being said, caution must be exercised in how you present your statistics. Firstly, parties should understand what the statistics mean and ensure that they provide value. In the past, parties have gone into arbitration hearings and used stats such as impactful hits. What exactly is an impactful hit, you might be thinking? Well, that's a great question because no one knows. If the arbitrator and the parties don't know what to make of the statistics, they probably aren't going to help much in making your decision. Additionally, humans are prone to what are called cognitive biases, including one called confirmation bias. This is a tendency to accept information that conforms with one's pre-existing views and beliefs. If you see a set of evidence, you might interpret it to be in favor of your side, when really it could go either way. Or you might look at pieces of information and only accept those that are in line with your beliefs, and then discount the information that isn't. This is normal. It happens for everyone unconsciously. This can work in your favor, as you can present statistics in such a way that they help you push your narrative. However, parties ought to be careful and explain the meaning behind their statistics. You can never assume that the meaning behind your stats are obvious and the value that they convey is obvious, because it's really not. You're starting from your own position of confirmation bias. Obviously, you think the stats support your position because you're partial to one side and you know that side of the story incredibly well. The best practice would be to explain it like the other parties have zero knowledge, because they do. You have to take the arbitrator away from your perspective or the other side's perspective, put them in the neutral seat, explain your case, and your stats will drive the narrative for you. Now, this is also helpful from a legal perspective because the processes tend to progress far less rapidly than the sports and the perspectives that inform the ways of thinking pretty much do. You look at analytics, and like I said, they took sports by storm. Now, you talk about individuals such as the arbitrator, and not all of them are going to understand the value of analytics or what they tend to explain. One shouldn't shy away from using newer analytics just because the arbitrator might not understand them, but instead you just have to recognize that, hey, it's going to take a little more time and a little more explaining to do so, and just make sure that you do it well enough to support your case. Now, one of my personal favorite arbitration hearings was one not from hockey but from the world of baseball because of how refreshing the approach of the team was. Mookie Betts, who is, at least in my opinion, one of the best baseball players in the world, was a member of the Boston Red Sox and filed for arbitration. Instead of tearing him down and talking about how he wasn't anywhere near as good as he said he was, like we saw in the Mike Milbury story, the Red Sox took a different approach. They focused on star Chicago Cub Chris Bryant, and they made the focus of their argument how outstanding of a player Bryant was, and what he got paid on his last contract was a little more than what Mookie should be paid because Mookie's numbers, while outstanding, weren't quite those of Bryant. Thus, it set a sort of ceiling on what Betts' salary typically could be, without having to put a ceiling on Betts' performance or his value to his team. This is the kind of approach that can go a long way to ensuring relationships remain intact. And hey, maybe Chris Bryant hears about this story from the Red Sox, and one day he decides, hey, if this team values me so much, I wouldn't mind playing for them. The benefits are plentiful. I've talked a lot about sports arbitration and the processes involved. I personally think it's useful because, as a fan of various sports myself, you never quite know what goes on behind closed doors. But in terms of taking it to a real-life employment context, I think it's very applicable. sports arbitration mirrors real life in a lot of ways. The athletes are the employees. The league and the teams are the employer. You have the same vulnerability as the athletes slash employees have less manpower and resources than the organized league offices. So returning to the implications of COVID-19, there's an issue as the arbitration cases rise. As I mentioned before, there's the normal risk of relationships souring and players being traded. But from a pure effectiveness standpoint and talking about the vulnerability of employees, in leagues such as the NHL, the Players Association plays a big part in preparing briefs and helping the players through the arbitration process. This is a great help, except if arbitration hearings increase due to COVID, this strains the resources even further as they have to manage a number of cases that is much larger than what they've done in the past. You compare this to the teams which are on the other side, and they might only have one or two players filing for arbitration, so that strains their resources a lot less so they can do a lot more preparation and bring a lot more statistics and evidence to the table that the player might not be able to. This puts them at a further disadvantage and shows how the process might swing a little more in favor of the employer. I think a pertinent example of how sports arbitration does mirror the real-life context would be in the use of statistics to measure how well an employee is doing their job. Sure, we don't have time on ice to measure how long an employee spends talking to an important client in the boardroom, or how long they spend walking to the fridge to grab a snack. What we do have are metrics to evaluate how efficient an employee is at doing their job. How much in sales did they bring in last year? Yeah, while we don't have the same natural stats as you would coming from a sport, there's certainly an importance in metrics and statistics, and they hold the exact same value of stats aren't going to lie to you. If you have the stats and they back up your case, it's going to make you a lot more persuasive. Now, I've talked about how it could help the two parties come to a more efficient solution through arbitration, but what about the process itself? Without going into a full examination of the arbitration process and its flaws, one potential area would be the difference between the NHL's process and the MLB's process. In the NHL, two sides submit their ideal values and briefs, and then they argue their position. The arbitrator then has to pick one of their sides, or they can find a compromise in the middle ground. Sounds pretty good, right? But in the MLB, the two sides submit what they feel is their best offer, they argue their position to the fullest, and then the arbitrator picks between their two offers. There is no middle ground. Now, you can see why the MLB's process may lead to more reasonable bargaining. I didn't at first, but I think this opened my eyes a lot to it. In the NHL, you tend to see each party not submit the most reasonable numbers. The player tends to come in at a contract value that's probably a little higher than what they're worth, and the team lowballs them and gives a contract offer that's a little less than what they're worth. They know that they each have to come at kind of unreasonable numbers, because when the arbitrator eventually picks a middle ground, it's going to be closer to the reasonable number that they wanted in the first place. So this seems a little sideways, right? In the MLB, you can see each side try to present the most reasonable number possible because that is the best final position. Parties must commit to and argue the reasonable number in order to have a chance at winning. The party that is the most reasonable is the one that comes out ahead. So I'd like to see the NHL reconsider allowing the arbitrator to choose a middle ground. I think a change to the process that injects a little more reasonableness would be a welcome development. Not only will it help with more effective arguments and a more efficient process, I think it could have a positive impact on what we discussed earlier with the emotional arguments and hurt feelings. It's harder to stray into personal attacks and teardowns when you're forced to present the most reasonable position possible. I know I've covered a lot of information in a relatively short period of time today, so here are five main takeaways from our discussion. Firstly, statistics can have incredible value in the arbitration process as a source of objective evidence. However, the parties using the statistics must be careful to only include meaningful stats and explain the meaning behind those numbers. Secondly, the arbitration process is part of a business and is meant to be professional. Be innovative and find ways to build your case without resorting to teardowns or personal attacks. Next, you should try to consider arbitration from a cost-benefit analysis perspective. Is our potential gain worth the relationships and the financial costs that are potentially at risk here? Fourth, arbitration doesn't have to be scary nor some terrible thing. You can implement progressive practices and work to make the process work for you. It has its benefits if you can escape the negative stereotypes and tendencies that come with it. And finally, all of these takeaways are subject to present circumstances. As of the time of this recording, one such circumstance is COVID-19, which is wreaking havoc on parties' abilities to negotiate, their expectations for the process, and more. Flexibility and responding to unique situations is key. While far from covering every part of arbitration, I hope this provided meaningful insight into what the sports arbitration process typically entails in the major league sports. There have been some amusing and some horrifying tales that have emerged from these hearings, and they help to illustrate how parties could approach the process better. I don't mean for this to be any sort of guide for approaching arbitration. Every case is unique and it requires its own unique approach. Instead, it's more just food for thought on potential ways to try and make the arbitration process a little less of a monster in the closet, especially with the pandemic seemingly making it more of a necessity than ever. Thank you for listening to this week's episode. I hope you found it informative, and I hope it stimulates some thought and discussion on the current process of sports arbitration and how parties can partake in it more effectively. I'd like to remind you that this is only general legal information and none of this should be treated as legal advice. If you have needs relating to arbitration, please seek the assistance of a legal professional. Stay safe, take care, and we'll see you soon for another episode of Pro Bono Radio.